of man. Nor are they all-powerful gods who run the world as they wish. The world does not revolve around humans or around any other particular group of beings. Animism is not a specific religion. It is a generic name for thousands of very different religions, cults, and beliefs. What makes all of them animist is this common approach to the world and to man's place in it. Saying that ancient foragers were probably animists is like saying that pre-modern agriculturalists were mostly theists. Theism, from theos, God in Greek, is the view that the universal order is based on a hierarchical relationship between humans and a small group of ethereal entities called gods. It is certainly true to say that pre-modern agriculturists tended to be theists, but it does not teach us much about the particulars. The generic rubric theists covers Jewish rabbis from 18th century Poland, witch-burning Puritans from 17th century Massachusetts, Aztec priests from 15th century Mexico, Sufi mystics from 12th century Iran, 10th century Viking warriors, 2nd century Roman legionaries, and 1st century Chinese bureaucrats. Each of these viewed the other's beliefs and practices as weird and heretical. The differences between the beliefs and practices of groups of animistic foragers were probably just as big. Their religious experience may have been turbulent and filled with controversies, reforms, and revolutions. But these cautious generalizations are about as far as we can go. Any attempt to describe the specifics of archaic spirituality is highly speculative, as there is next to no evidence to go by, and the little evidence we have, a handful of artifacts and cave paintings, can be interpreted in myriad ways. The theories of scholars who claim to know what the foragers felt shed much more light on the prejudices of their authors than on Stone Age religions. Instead of erecting mountains of theory over a molehill of tomb relics, cave paintings, and bone statuettes, it is better to be frank and admit that we have only the haziest notions about the religions of ancient foragers. We assume that they were animists, but that's not very informative. We don't know which spirits they prayed to, which festivals they celebrated, or which taboos they observed. Most importantly, we don't know what stories they told. It's one of the biggest holes in our understanding of human history. The socio-political world of the foragers is another area about which we know next to nothing. As explained, scholars cannot even agree on the basics, such as the existence of private property, nuclear families, and monogamous relationships. It's likely that different bands had different structures. Some may have been as hierarchical, tense, and violent as the nastiest chimpanzee group, while others were as laid-back, peaceful, and lascivious as a bunch of bonobos. In Sungir, Russia, archaeologists discovered in 1955 a 30,000-year-old burial site belonging to a mammoth-hunting culture. In one grave they found the skeleton of a 50-year-old man, covered with strings of mammoth ivory beads, containing about 3,000 beads in total. On the dead man's head was a hat decorated with fox teeth, and on his wrists 25 ivory bracelets. Other graves from the same site contained far fewer goods. Scholars deduced that the Sungir mammoth hunters lived in a hierarchical society, and that the dead man was perhaps the leader of a band or of an entire tribe comprising several bands. It is unlikely that a few dozen members of a single band could have produced so many grave goods by themselves. Archaeologists then discovered an even more interesting tomb. It contained two skeletons buried head to head. One belonged to a boy aged about 12 or 13, and the other to a girl of about 9 or 10. The boy was covered with 5,000 ivory beads. He wore a fox-tooth hat and a belt with 250 fox teeth. At least 60 foxes had to have had their teeth pulled to get that many. The girl was adorned with 5,250 ivory beads. Both children were surrounded by statuettes and various ivory objects. A skilled craftsman or craftswoman probably needed about 45 minutes to prepare a single ivory bead. In other words, fashioning the 10,000 ivory beads that covered the two children, not to mention the other objects, required some 7,500 hours of delicate work, well over 3 years of labour by an experienced artisan. It is highly unlikely that at such a young age the Sungir children had proved themselves as leaders or mammoth hunters. Only cultural beliefs can explain why they received such an extravagant burial. One theory is that they owed their rank to their parents. Perhaps they were the children of the leader, in a culture that believed in either family charisma or strict rules of succession. According to a second theory, the children had been identified at birth as the incarnations of some long-dead spirits. A third theory argues that the children's burial reflects the way they died rather than their status in life. They were ritually sacrificed, perhaps as part of the burial rites of the leader, and then entombed with pomp and circumstance. Whatever the correct answer, the Sungir children are among the best pieces of evidence that 30,000 years ago, sapiens could invent socio-political codes that went far beyond the dictates of our DNA and the behavior patterns of other human and animal species. Peace or war? Finally, there's the thorny question of the role of war in forager societies. Some scholars imagine ancient hunter-gatherer societies as peaceful paradises, and argue that war and violence began only with the agricultural revolution, when people started to accumulate private property. Other scholars maintain that the world of the ancient foragers was exceptionally cruel and violent. Both schools of thought are castles in the air, connected to the ground by the thin strings of meager archaeological remains and anthropological observations of present-day foragers. The anthropological evidence is intriguing but very problematic. Foragers today live mainly in isolated and inhospitable areas such as the Arctic or the Kalahari, where population density is very low and opportunities to fight other people are limited. Moreover, in recent generations, foragers have been increasingly subject to the authority of modern states, which prevent the eruption of large-scale conflicts. European scholars have had only two opportunities to observe large and relatively dense populations of independent foragers, in northwestern North America in the 19th century and in northern Australia during the 19th and early 20th centuries. Both Amerindian and Aboriginal Australian cultures witnessed frequent armed conflicts. It is debatable, however, whether this represents a timeless condition or the impact of European imperialism. The archaeological findings are both scarce and opaque. What telltale clues might remain of any war that took place tens of thousands of years ago? There were no fortifications and walls back then, no artillery shells or even swords and shields. An ancient spear point might have been used in war, but it could have been used in a hunt as well. Fossilized human bones are no less hard to interpret. A fracture might indicate a war wound or an accident. Nor is the absence of fractures and cuts on an ancient skeleton conclusive proof that the person to whom the skeleton belonged did not die a violent death. Death can be caused by trauma to soft tissues that leaves no marks on bone. Even more importantly, during pre-industrial warfare, more than 90% of war dead were killed by starvation, cold, and disease, rather than by weapons. Imagine that 30,000 years ago, one tribe defeated its neighbor and expelled it from coveted foraging grounds. In the decisive battle, 10 members of the defeated tribe were killed. In the following year, another 100 members of the losing tribe died from starvation, cold, and disease. Archaeologists who come across these 110 skeletons may too easily conclude that most fell victim to some natural disaster. How would we be able to tell that they were all victims of a merciless war? Duly warned, we can now turn to the archaeological findings. In Portugal, a survey was made of 400 skeletons from the period immediately predating the agricultural revolution. Only 2 skeletons showed clear marks of violence. A similar survey of 400 skeletons from the same period in Israel discovered a single crack in a single skull that could be attributed to human violence. A third survey of 400 skeletons from various pre-agricultural sites in the Danube Valley found evidence of violence on 18 skeletons. 18 out of 400 may not sound like a lot, but it's actually a very high percentage. If all 18 indeed died violently, it means that about 4.5% of deaths in the ancient Danube Valley were caused by human violence. Today, the global average is only 1.5%, taking war and crime together. During the 20th century, only 5% of human deaths resulted from human violence, and this in a century that saw the bloodiest wars and most massive genocides in history. If this revelation is typical, the ancient Danube Valley was as violent as the 20th century. The depressing findings from the Danube Valley are supported by a string of equally depressing findings from other areas. At Jabal Sahaba in Sudan, a 12,000-year-old cemetery containing 59 skeletons was discovered. Arrowheads and spear points were found embedded in or lying near the bones of 24 skeletons, 40% of the find. The skeleton of one woman revealed 12 injuries. In Offnet Cave in Bavaria, archaeologists discovered the remains of 38 foragers, mainly women and children, who had been thrown into two burial pits. Half the skeletons, including those of children and babies, bore clear signs of damage by human weapons such as clubs and knives. The few skeletons belonging to mature males bore the worst marks of violence. In all probability, an entire forager band was massacred at Offnet. Which better represents the world of the ancient foragers, the peaceful skeletons from Israel and Portugal, or the abattoirs of Jabal Sahaba and Offnet? The answer is neither. Just as foragers exhibited a wide array of religions and social structures, so too did they probably demonstrate a variety of violence rates. While some areas and some periods of time may have enjoyed peace and tranquility, others were riven by ferocious conflicts. The Curtain of Silence. If the larger picture of ancient forager life is hard to reconstruct, particular events are largely irretrievable. When a sapiens band first entered a valley inhabited by Neanderthals, the following years might have witnessed a breathtaking historical drama. Unfortunately, nothing would have survived from such an encounter except, at best, a few fossilized bones and a handful of stone tools that remain mute under the most intense scholarly inquisitions. We may extract from them information about human anatomy, human technology, human diet, and perhaps even human social structure. But they reveal nothing about the political alliance forged between neighboring sapiens bands, about the spirits of the dead that bless this alliance, or about the ivory beads secretly given to the local witch doctor in order to secure the blessing of the spirits. This curtain of silence shrouds tens of thousands of years of history. These long millennia may well have witnessed wars and revolutions, ecstatic religious movements, profound philosophical theories, incomparable artistic masterpieces. The foragers may have had their all-conquering Napoleons, who ruled empires half the size of Luxembourg, gifted Beethovens, who lacked symphony orchestras, but brought people to tears with the sound of their bamboo flutes, and charismatic prophets who revealed the words of a local oak tree rather than those of a universal creator god. But these are all mere guesses. The curtain of silence is so thick that we cannot even be sure such things occurred, let alone describe them in detail. Scholars tend to ask only those questions that they can reasonably expect to answer. Without the discovery of as yet unavailable research tools, we will probably never know what the ancient foragers believed or what political dramas they experienced. Yet it is vital to ask questions for which no answers are available, otherwise we might be tempted to dismiss 60,000 of 70,000 years of human history with the excuse that the people who lived back then did nothing of importance. The truth is that they did a lot of important things. In particular, they shaped the world around us to a much larger degree than most people realize. Trekkers visiting the Siberian tundra, the deserts of central Australia, and the Amazonian rainforest believe that they have entered pristine landscapes, virtually untouched by human hands. But that's an illusion. The foragers were there before us, and they brought about dramatic changes even in the densest jungles and the most desolate wildernesses. The next chapter explains how the foragers completely reshaped the ecology of our planet long before the first agricultural village was built. The wandering bands of storytelling sapiens were the most important and most destructive force the animal kingdom had ever produced. 4. The Flood. Prior to the cognitive revolution, humans of all species lived exclusively on the Afro-Asian landmass. True, they had settled a few islands by swimming short stretches of water or crossing them on improvised rafts. Flores, for example, was colonized as far back as 850,000 years ago. Yet they were unable to venture into the open sea, and none reached America, Australia, or remote islands such as Madagascar, New Zealand, and Hawaii. The sea barrier prevented not just humans, but also many other Afro-Asian animals and plants, from reaching this outer world. As a result, the organisms of distant lands like Australia and Madagascar evolved in isolation for millions upon millions of years, taking on shapes and natures very different from those of their distant Afro-Asian relatives. Planet Earth was separated into several distinct ecosystems, each made up of a unique assembly of animals and plants. Homo sapiens was about to put an end to this biological exuberance. Following the cognitive revolution, sapiens acquired the technology, the organizational skills, and perhaps even the vision necessary to break out of Afro-Asia and settle the outer world. Their first achievement was the colonization of Australia some 45,000 years ago. Experts are hard-pressed to explain this feat. In order to reach Australia, humans had to cross a number of sea channels, some more than 60 miles wide, and upon arrival they had to adapt nearly overnight to a completely new ecosystem. The most reasonable theory suggests that about 45,000 years ago, the sapiens living in the Indonesian archipelago, a group of islands separated from Asia and from each other by only narrow straits, developed the first seafaring societies. They learned how to build and maneuver ocean-going vessels and became long-distance fishermen, traders, and explorers. This would have brought about an unprecedented transformation in human capabilities and lifestyles. Every other mammal that went to sea, seals, sea cows, dolphins, had to evolve for eons to develop specialized organs and a hydrodynamic body. The sapiens in Indonesia, descendants of apes who lived on the African savanna, became Pacific seafarers without growing flippers and without having to wait for their noses to migrate to the top of their heads as whales did. Instead, they built boats and learned how to steer them. And these skills enabled them to reach and settle Australia. True, archaeologists have yet to unearth rafts, oars, or fishing villages that date back as far as 45,000 years ago. They would be difficult to discover, because rising sea levels have buried the ancient Indonesian shoreline under 300 feet of ocean. Nevertheless, there is strong circumstantial evidence to support this theory, especially the fact that in the thousands of years following the settlement of Australia, sapiens colonized a large number of small and isolated islands to its north. Some, such as Buka and Manus, were separated from the closest land by 120 miles of open water. It's hard to believe that anyone could have reached and colonized Manus without sophisticated vessels and sailing skills. As mentioned earlier, there is also firm evidence for regular sea trade between some of these islands, such as New Ireland and New Britain. The journey of the first humans to Australia is one of the most important events in history, at least as important as Columbus' journey to America or the Apollo 11 expedition to the moon. It was the first time any human had managed to leave the Afro-Asian ecological system. Indeed, the first time any large terrestrial mammal had managed to cross from Afro-Asia to Australia. Of even greater importance was what the human pioneers did in this new world. The moment the first hunter-gatherer set foot on an Australian beach was the moment that Homo sapiens climbed to the top rung in the food chain on a particular landmass and thereafter became the deadliest species in the annals of planet Earth. Up until then, humans had displayed some innovative adaptations and behaviours, but their effect on their environment had been negligible. They had demonstrated remarkable success in moving into and adjusting to various habitats, but they did so without drastically changing those habitats. The settlers of Australia, or more accurately, its conquerors, didn't just adapt. They transformed the Australian ecosystem beyond recognition. The first human footprint on a sandy Australian beach was immediately washed away by the waves. Yet, when the invaders advanced inland, they left behind a different footprint, one that would never be expunged. As they pushed on, they encountered a strange universe of unknown creatures that included a 450-pound, 6-foot kangaroo and a marsupial lion, as massive as a modern tiger, that was the continent's largest predator. Koalas, far too big to be cuddly and cute, rustled in the trees, and flightless birds, twice the size of ostriches, sprinted on the plains. Dragon-like lizards and snakes 7 feet long slithered through the undergrowth. The giant Diprotodon, a 2.5-ton wombat, roamed the forests. Except for the birds and reptiles, all these animals were marsupials. Like kangaroos, they gave birth to tiny, helpless, fetus-like young, which they then nurtured with milk in abdominal pouches. Marsupial mammals were almost unknown in Africa and Asia, but in Australia they reigned supreme. Within a few thousand years, virtually all of these giants vanished. Of the 24 Australian animal species weighing 100 pounds or more, 23 became extinct. A large number of smaller species also disappeared. Food chains throughout the entire Australian ecosystem were broken and rearranged. It was the most important transformation of the Australian ecosystem for millions of years. Was it all the fault of Homo sapiens? Guilty as charged. Some scholars try to exonerate our species, placing the blame on the vagaries of the climate, the usual scapegoat in such cases. Yet it is hard to believe that Homo sapiens was completely innocent. There are three pieces of evidence that weaken the climate alibi and implicate our ancestors in the extinction of the Australian megafauna. Firstly, even though Australia's climate changed some 45,000 years ago, it wasn't a very remarkable upheaval. It's hard to see how the new weather patterns alone could have caused such a massive extinction. It's common today to explain anything and everything as the result of climate change, but the truth is that Earth's climate never rests. It is in constant flux. Every event in history occurred against the background of some climate change. In particular, our planet has experienced numerous cycles of cooling and warming. During the last million years, there has been an ice age, on average, every 100,000 years. The last one ran from about 75,000 to 15,000 years ago. Not unusually severe for an ice age, it had twin peaks, the first about 70,000 years ago, and the second at about 20,000 years ago. The giant Diprotodon appeared in Australia more than 1.5 million years ago and successfully weathered at least 10 previous ice ages. It also survived the first peak of the last ice age around 70,000 years ago. Why, then, did it disappear 45,000 years ago? Of course, if Diprotodons had been the only large animal to disappear at this time, it might have been just a fluke. But more than 90% of Australia's megafauna disappeared along with the Diprotodon. The evidence is circumstantial, but it's hard to imagine that sapiens, just by coincidence, arrived in Australia at the precise point that all these animals were dropping dead of the chills. Secondly, when climate change causes mass extinctions, sea creatures are usually hit as hard as land dwellers. Yet there is no evidence of any significant disappearance of oceanic fauna 45,000 years ago. Human involvement can easily explain why the wave of extinction obliterated the terrestrial megafauna of Australia while sparing that of the nearby oceans. Despite its burgeoning navigational abilities, Homo sapiens was still overwhelmingly a terrestrial menace. Thirdly, Mass extinctions akin to the archetypal Australian decimation occurred again and again in the ensuing millennia, whenever people settled another part of the outer world. In these cases, sapiens' guilt is irrefutable. For example, the megafauna of New Zealand, which had weathered the alleged climate change of approximately 45,000 years ago without a scratch, suffered devastating blows immediately after the first humans set foot on the islands. The Maoris, New Zealand's first sapiens colonizers, reached the islands about 800 years ago. Within a couple of centuries, the majority of the local megafauna was extinct, along with 60% of all bird species. A similar fate befell the mammoth population of Wrangel Island in the Arctic Ocean, 125 miles north of the Siberian coast. Mammoths had flourished for millions of years over most of the Northern Hemisphere, but as Homo sapiens spread, first over Eurasia and then over North America, the mammoths retreated. By 10,000 years ago, there was not a single mammoth to be found in the world, except on a few remote Arctic islands, most conspicuously Wrangel. The mammoths of Wrangel continued to prosper for a few more millennia, then suddenly disappeared about 4,000 years ago, just when the first humans reached the island. Were the Australian extinction an isolated event, we could grant humans the benefit of the doubt. But the historical record makes Homo sapiens look like an ecological serial killer. All the settlers of Australia had at their disposal was Stone Age technology. How could they cause an ecological disaster? There are three explanations that mesh quite nicely. Large animals, the primary victims of the Australian extinction, breed slowly. Pregnancy is long, offspring per pregnancy are few, and there are long breaks between pregnancies. Consequently, if humans cut down even one diprotodon every few months, it would be enough to cause diprotodon deaths to outnumber births. Within a few thousand years, the last lonesome diprotodon would pass away, and with her, the entire species. In fact, for all their size, diprotodons and Australia's other giants probably wouldn't have been that hard to hunt, because they would have been taken totally by surprise by their two-legged assailants. Various human species had been prowling and evolving in Afro-Asia for 2 million years. They slowly honed their hunting skills and began going after large animals around 400,000 years ago. The big beasts of Africa and Asia learned to avoid humans, so when the new mega-predator, Homo sapiens, appeared on the Afro-Asian scene, the large animals already knew to keep their distance from creatures that looked like it. In contrast, the Australian giants had no time to learn to run away. Humans don't come across as particularly dangerous. They don't have long, sharp teeth or muscular, lithe bodies. So when a diprotodon, the largest marsupial ever to walk the earth, set eyes for the first time on this frail-looking ape, he probably gave it one glance and then went back to chewing leaves. These animals had to evolve a fear of humankind, but before they could do so, they were gone. The second explanation is that by the time sapiens reached Australia, they had already mastered fire agriculture. Faced with an alien and threatening environment, it seems that they deliberately burned vast areas of impassable thickets and dense forests to create open grasslands, which attracted more easily hunted game and were better suited to their needs. They thereby completely changed the ecology of large parts of Australia within a few short millennia. One body of evidence supporting this view is the fossil plant record. Eucalyptus trees were rare in Australia 45,000 years ago, but the arrival of Homo sapiens inaugurated a golden age for the species. Since eucalyptuses are particularly resistant to fire, they spread far and wide while other trees and shrubs disappeared. These changes in vegetation influenced the animals that ate the plants and the carnivores that ate the vegetarians. Koalas, which subsist exclusively on eucalyptus leaves, happily munched their way into new territories. Most other animals suffered greatly. Many Australian food chains collapsed, driving the weakest links into extinction. A third explanation agrees that hunting and fire agriculture played a significant role in the extinction, but emphasizes that we can't completely ignore the role of climate. The climate changes that beset Australia about 45,000 years ago destabilized the ecosystem and made it particularly vulnerable. Under normal circumstances, the system would probably have recuperated, as had happened many times previously. However, humans appeared on the stage at just this critical juncture and pushed the brittle ecosystem into the abyss. The combination of climate change and human hunting is particularly devastating for large animals, since it attacks them from different angles. It is hard to find a good survival strategy that will work simultaneously against multiple threats. Without further evidence, there's no way of deciding between the three scenarios. But there are certainly good reasons to believe that if Homo sapiens had never gone down under, it would still be home to marsupial lions, diprotodons, and giant kangaroos. The end of sloth. The extinction of the Australian megafauna was probably the first significant mark Homo sapiens left on our planet. It was followed by an even larger ecological disaster, this time in America. Homo sapiens was the first and only human species to reach the Western Hemisphere landmass, arriving about 16,000 years ago, that is, in or around 14,000 BC. The first Americans arrived on foot, which they could do because, at the time, sea levels were low enough that a land bridge connected northeastern Siberia with northwestern Alaska. Not that it was easy. The journey was an arduous one, perhaps harder than the sea passage to Australia. To make the crossing, sapiens first had to learn how to withstand the extreme Arctic conditions of northern Siberia, an area on which the sun never shines in winter, and where temperatures can drop to minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. No previous human species had managed to penetrate places like northern Siberia. Even the cold-adapted Neanderthals restricted themselves to relatively warmer regions further south. But Homo sapiens, whose body was adapted to living in the African savanna rather than in the lands of snow and ice, devised ingenious solutions. When roaming bands of sapiens foragers migrated into colder climates, they learned to make snowshoes and effective thermal clothing composed of layers of furs and skins sewn together tightly with the help of needles. They developed new weapons and sophisticated hunting techniques that enabled them to track and kill mammoths and the other big game of the far north. As their thermal clothing and hunting techniques improved, sapiens dared to venture deeper and deeper into the frozen regions. And as they moved north, their clothes, hunting strategies, and other survival skills continued to improve. But why did they bother? Why banish oneself to Siberia by choice? Perhaps some bands were driven north by wars, demographic pressures, or natural disasters. Others might have been lured northwards by more positive reasons, such as animal protein. The Arctic lands were full of large, juicy animals, such as reindeer and mammoths. Every mammoth was a source of a vast quantity of meat, which, given the frosty temperatures, could even be frozen for later use. Tasty fat, warm fur, and valuable ivory. As the findings from Sungir testify, mammoth hunters did not just survive in the frozen north, they thrived. As time passed, the band spread far and wide, pursuing mammoths, mastodons, rhinoceroses, and reindeer. Around 14,000 BC, the chase took some of them from northeastern Siberia to Alaska. Of course, they didn't know they were discovering a new world. For mammoth and man alike, Alaska was a mere extension of Siberia. At first, glaciers blocked the way from Alaska to the rest of America, allowing no more than perhaps a few isolated pioneers to investigate the lands further south. However, around 12,000 BC, global warming melted the ice and opened an easier passage. Making use of the new corridor, people moved south en masse, spreading over the entire continent. Though originally adapted to hunting large game in the Arctic, they soon adjusted to an amazing variety of climates and ecosystems. Descendants of the Siberians settled the thick forests of the eastern United States, the swamps of the Mississippi Delta, the deserts of Mexico, and steaming jungles of Central America. Some made their homes in the river world of the Amazon basin. Others struck roots in Andean mountain valleys or the open pampas of Argentina. And all this happened in a mere millennium or two. By 10,000 BC, humans already inhabited the most southern point in America, the island of Tierra del Fuego, at the continent's southern tip. The human blitzkrieg across America testifies to the incomparable ingenuity and the unsurpassed adaptability of Homo sapiens. No other animal had ever moved into such a huge variety of radically different habitats so quickly, everywhere using virtually the same genes. The settling of America was hardly bloodless. It left behind a long trail of victims. American fauna 14,000 years ago was far richer than it is today. When the first Americans marched south from Alaska into the plains of Canada and the western United States, they encountered mammoths and mastodons, rodents the size of bears, herds of horses and camels, oversized lions, and dozens of large species, the likes of which are completely unknown today. Among them, fearsome saber-toothed cats and giant ground sloths that weighed up to 8 tons and reached a height of 20 feet. South America hosted an even more exotic menagerie of large mammals, reptiles, and birds. The Americas were a great laboratory of evolutionary experimentation, a place where animals and plants unknown in Africa and Asia had evolved and thrived. But no longer. Within 2,000 years of the sapiens' arrival, most of these unique species were gone. According to current estimates, within that short interval, North America lost 34 out of its 47 genera of large mammals. South America lost 50 out of 60. The saber-toothed cats, after flourishing for more than 30 million years, disappeared, and so did the giant ground sloths, the oversized lions, Native American horses, Native American camels, the giant rodents, and the mammoths. Thousands of species of smaller mammals, reptiles, birds, and even insects and parasites also became extinct. When the mammoths died out, all species of mammoth ticks followed them to oblivion. For decades, paleontologists and zooarchaeologists, people who search for and study animal remains, have been combing the plains and mountains of the Americas in search of the fossilized bones of ancient camels and the petrified feces of giant ground sloths. When they find what they seek, the treasures are carefully packed up and sent to laboratories, where every bone and every coprolite, the technical name for fossilized turds, is meticulously studied and dated. Time and again, these analyses yield the same results. The freshest dung balls and the most recent camel bones date to the period when humans flooded America, that is, between approximately 12,000 and 9,000 BC. Only in one area have scientists discovered younger dung balls. On several Caribbean islands, in particular Cuba and Hispaniola, they found petrified ground sloth scats dating to about 5,000 BC. This is exactly the time when the first humans managed to cross the Caribbean Sea and settle these two large islands. Again, some scholars try to exonerate Homo sapiens and blame climate change, which requires them to posit that, for some mysterious reason, the climate in the Caribbean islands remained static for 7,000 years while the rest of the Western Hemisphere warmed. But in America, the dung ball cannot be dodged. We are the culprits. There is no way around that truth. Even if climate change abetted us, the human contribution was decisive. Noah's Ark. If we combine the mass extinctions in Australia and America, and add the smaller-scale extinctions that took place as Homo sapiens spread over Afro-Asia, such as the extinction of all other human species, and the extinctions that occurred when ancient foragers settled remote islands such as Cuba, the inevitable conclusion is that the first wave of sapiens colonization was one of the biggest and swiftest ecological disasters to befall the animal kingdom. Hardest hit were the large furry creatures. At the time of the Cognitive Revolution, the planet was home to about 200 genera of large terrestrial mammals weighing over 100 pounds. At the time of the Agricultural Revolution, only about 100 remained. Homo sapiens drove to extinction about half of the planet's big beasts long before humans invented the wheel, writing, or iron tools. This ecological tragedy was restaged in miniature countless times after the agricultural revolution. The archaeological record of island after island tells the same sad story. The tragedy opens with a scene showing a rich and varied population of large animals without any trace of humans. In scene two, sapiens appear, evidenced by a human bone, a spear point, or perhaps a potsherd. Scene three quickly follows, in which men and women occupy center stage and most large animals, along with many smaller ones, are gone. The large island of Madagascar, about 250 miles east of the African mainland, offers a famous example. Through millions of years of isolation, a unique collection of animals evolved there. These included the elephant bird, a flightless creature 10 feet tall and weighing almost half a ton, the largest bird in the world, and the giant lemurs, the globe's largest primates. The elephant birds and the giant lemurs, along with most of the other large animals of Madagascar, suddenly vanished about 1,500 years ago, precisely when the first humans set foot on the island. In the Pacific Ocean, the main wave of extinction began in about 1,500 BC, when Polynesian farmers settled the Solomon Islands, Fiji, and New Caledonia. They killed off, directly or indirectly, hundreds of species of birds, insects, snails, and other local inhabitants. From there, the wave of extinction moved gradually to the east, the south, and the north, into the heart of the Pacific Ocean, obliterating on its way the unique fauna of Samoa and Tonga, 1200 BC, the Marquis Islands, AD 1, Easter Island, the Cook Islands, and Hawaii, AD 500, and finally New Zealand, AD 1200. Similar ecological disasters occurred on almost every one of the thousands of islands that pepper the Atlantic Ocean, Indian Ocean, Arctic Ocean, and Mediterranean Sea. Archaeologists have discovered on even the tiniest islands evidence of the existence of birds, insects, and snails that lived there for countless generations, only to vanish when the first human farmers arrived. None but a few extremely remote islands escaped man's notice until the modern age, and these islands kept their fauna intact. The Galapagos Islands, to give one famous example, remained uninhabited by humans until the 19th century, thus preserving their unique menagerie, including their giant tortoises, which, like the ancient diprotodons, show no fear of humans. The first wave extinction, which accompanied the spread of the foragers, was followed by the second wave extinction, which accompanied the spread of the farmers, and gives us an important perspective on the third wave extinction, which industrial activity is causing today. Don't believe tree-huggers, who claim that our ancestors lived in harmony with nature. Long before the Industrial Revolution, Homo sapiens held the record among all organisms for driving the most plant and animal species to their extinctions. We have the dubious distinction of being the deadliest species in the annals of biology. Perhaps if more people were aware of the first wave and second wave extinctions, they'd be less nonchalant about the third wave they are part of. If we knew how many species we've already eradicated, we might be more motivated to protect those that still survive. This is especially relevant to the large animals of the oceans. Unlike their terrestrial counterparts, the large sea animals suffered relatively little from the cognitive and agricultural revolutions. But many of them are on the brink of extinction now as a result of industrial pollution and human overuse of oceanic resources. If things continue at the present pace, it is likely that whales, sharks, tuna, and dolphins will follow the diprotodons, ground sloths, and mammoths to oblivion. Among all the world's large creatures, the only survivors of the human flood will be humans themselves, and the farmyard animals that serve as galley slaves in Noah's Ark. Part 2. The Agricultural Revolution. 5. History's Biggest Fraud. For 2.5 million years, humans fed themselves by gathering plants and hunting animals that lived and bred without their intervention. Homo erectus, Homo augusta, and the Neanderthals plucked wild figs and hunted wild sheep, without deciding where fig trees would take root, in which meadow a herd of sheep should graze, or which billy goat would inseminate which nanny goat. Homo sapiens spread from East Africa to the Middle East, to Europe and Asia, and finally to Australia and America. But everywhere they went, sapiens, too, continued to live by gathering wild plants and hunting wild animals. Why do anything else when your lifestyle feeds you amply and supports a rich world of social structures, religious beliefs, and political dynamics? All this changed about 10,000 years ago, when sapiens began to devote almost all their time and effort to manipulating the lives of a few animal and plant species. From sunrise to sunset, humans sowed seeds, watered plants, plucked weeds from the ground, and led sheep to prime pastures. This work, they thought, would provide them with more fruit, grain, and meat. It was a revolution in the way humans lived, the agricultural revolution. The transition to agriculture began around 9,500 to 8,500 BC in the hill country of southeastern Turkey, western Iran, and the Levant. It began slowly and in a restricted geographical area. Wheat and goats were domesticated by approximately 9,000 BC, peas and lentils around 8,000 BC, olive trees by 5,000 BC, horses by 4,000 BC, and grapevines in 3,500 BC. Some animals and plants, such as camels and cashew nuts, were domesticated even later. But by 3,500 BC, the main wave of domestication was over. Even today, with all our advanced technologies, more than 90% of the calories that feed humanity come from the handful of plants that our ancestors domesticated between 9,500 and 3,500 BC. Wheat, rice, maize, called corn in the US, potatoes, millet, and barley. No noteworthy plant or animal has been domesticated in the last 2,000 years. If our minds are those of hunter-gatherers, our cuisine is that of ancient farmers. Scholars once believed that agriculture spread from a single Middle Eastern point of origin to the four corners of the world. Today, scholars agree that agriculture sprang up in other parts of the world not by the action of Middle Eastern farmers exporting their revolution, but entirely independently. People in Central America domesticated maize and beans without knowing anything about wheat and pea cultivation in the Middle East. South Americans learned how to raise potatoes and llamas, unaware of what was going on in either Mexico or the Levant. China's first revolutionaries domesticated rice, millet, and pigs. North America's first gardeners were those who got tired of combing the undergrowth for edible gourds and decided to cultivate pumpkins. New Guineans tamed sugarcane and bananas, while the first West African farmers made African millet, African rice, sorghum, and wheat conform to their needs. From these initial focal points, agriculture spread far and wide. By the first century AD, the vast majority of people throughout most of the world were agriculturists. Why did agricultural revolutions erupt in the Middle East, China, and Central America, but not in Australia, Alaska, or South Africa? The reason is simple. Most species of plants and animals can't be domesticated. Sapiens could dig up delicious truffles and hunt down woolly mammoths, but domesticating either species was out of the question. The fungi were far too elusive, the giant beasts too ferocious. Of the thousands of species that our ancestors hunted and gathered, only a few were suitable candidates for farming and herding. Those few species lived in particular places, and those are the places where agricultural revolutions occurred. Scholars once proclaimed that the agricultural revolution was a great leap forward for humanity. They told a tale of progress fueled by human brain power. Evolution gradually produced ever more intelligent people. Eventually, people were so smart that they were able to decipher nature's secrets, enabling them to tame sheep and cultivate wheat. As soon as this happened, they cheerfully abandoned the grueling, dangerous, and often Spartan life of hunter-gatherers, settling down to enjoy the pleasant, satiated life of farmers. That tale is a fantasy. there is no evidence that people became more intelligent with time. Foragers knew the secrets of nature long before the agricultural revolution, since their survival depended on an intimate knowledge of the animals they hunted and the plants they gathered. Rather than heralding a new era of easy living, the agricultural revolution left farmers with lives generally more difficult and less satisfying than those of foragers. Hunter-gatherers spent their time in more stimulating and varied ways, and were less in danger of starvation and disease. The agricultural revolution certainly enlarged the sum total of food at the disposal of humankind, but the extra food did not translate into a better diet or more leisure. Rather, it translated into population explosions and pampered elites. The average farmer worked harder than the average forager and got a worse diet in return. The agricultural revolution was history's biggest fraud. Who was responsible? Neither kings, nor priests, nor merchants. The culprits were a handful of plant species, including wheat, rice, and potatoes. These plants domesticated Homo sapiens, rather than vice versa. Think for a moment about the agricultural revolution from the viewpoint of wheat. 10,000 years ago, wheat was just a wild grass, one of many, confined to a small range in the Middle East. Suddenly, within just a few short millennia, it was growing all over the world. According to the basic evolutionary criteria of survival and reproduction, wheat has become one of the most successful plants in the history of the earth. In areas such as the Great Plains of North America, where not a single wheat stalk grew 10,000 years ago, you can today walk for hundreds upon hundreds of miles without encountering any other plant. Worldwide, wheat covers about 870,000 square miles of the globe's surface, almost 10 times the size of Britain. How did this grass turn from insignificant to ubiquitous? Wheat did it by manipulating Homo sapiens to its advantage. This ape had been living a fairly comfortable life, hunting and gathering, until about 10,000 years ago, but then began to invest more and more effort in cultivating wheat. Within a couple of millennia, humans in many parts of the world were doing little from dawn to dusk other than taking care of wheat plants. It wasn't easy. Wheat demanded a lot of them. Wheat didn't like rocks and pebbles, so sapiens broke their backs clearing fields. Wheat didn't like sharing its space, water and nutrients with other plants, so men and women labored long days weeding under the scorching sun. Wheat got sick, so sapiens had to keep a watch out for worms and blight. Wheat was attacked by rabbits and locust swarms, so the farmers built fences and stood guard over the fields. Wheat was thirsty, so humans dug irrigation canals or lugged heavy buckets from the well to water it. Sapiens even collected animal feces to nourish the ground in which wheat grew. The body of Homo sapiens had not evolved for such tasks. It was adapted to climbing apple trees and running after gazelles, not to clearing rocks and carrying water buckets. Human spines, knees, necks, and arches paid the price. Studies of ancient skeletons indicate that the transition to agriculture brought about a plethora of ailments, such as slipped discs, arthritis, and hernias. Moreover, the new agricultural tasks demanded so much time that people were forced to settle permanently next to their wheat fields. This completely changed their way of life. We did not domesticate wheat. It domesticated us. The word domesticates comes from the Latin domus, which means house. Who's the one living in a house? Not the wheat. It's the sapiens. How did wheat convince Homo sapiens to exchange a rather good life for a more miserable existence? What did it offer in return? It did not offer a better diet. Remember, humans are omnivorous apes who thrive on a wide variety of foods. Grains made up only a small fraction of the human diet before the agricultural revolution. A diet based on cereals is poor in minerals and vitamins, hard to digest, and really bad for your teeth and gums. Wheat did not give people economic security. The life of a peasant is less secure than that of a hunter-gatherer. Foragers relied on dozens of species to survive, and could, therefore, weather difficult years even without stocks of preserved food. If the availability of one species was reduced, they could gather and hunt more of other species. Farming societies have, until very recently, relied for the great bulk of their calorie intake on a small variety of domesticated plants. In many areas, they relied on just a single staple, such as wheat, potatoes, or rice. If the rains failed, or clouds of locusts arrived, or if a fungus infected that staple species, peasants died by the thousands and millions. Nor could wheat offer security against human violence. The early farmers were at least as violent as their forager ancestors, if not more so. Farmers had more possessions and needed land for planting. The loss of pasture land to raiding neighbors could mean the difference between subsistence and starvation, so there was much less room for compromise. When a foraging band was hard-pressed by a stronger rival, it could usually move on. It was difficult and dangerous, but it was feasible. When a strong enemy threatened an agricultural village, retreat meant giving up fields, houses, and granaries. In many cases, this doomed the refugees to starvation. Farmers, therefore, tended to stay put and fight to the bitter end. Many anthropological and archaeological studies indicate that in simple agricultural societies with no political frameworks beyond village and tribe, human violence was responsible for about 15% of deaths, including 25% of male deaths. In contemporary New Guinea, violence accounts for 30% of male deaths in one agricultural tribal society, the Dani, and 35% in another, the Enga. In Ecuador, perhaps 50% of adult Waudanis meet a violent death at the hands of another human. In time, human violence was brought under control through the development of larger social frameworks, cities, kingdoms, and states. But it took thousands of years to build such huge and effective political structures. Village life certainly brought the first farmers some immediate benefits, such as better protection against wild animals, rain, and cold. Yet, for the average person, the disadvantages probably outweighed the advantages. This is hard for people in today's prosperous societies to appreciate. Since we enjoy affluence and security, and since our affluence and security are built on foundations laid by the agricultural revolution, we assume that the agricultural revolution was a wonderful improvement. Yet it is wrong to judge thousands of years of history from the perspective of today. A much more representative viewpoint is that of a 3-year-old girl dying from malnutrition in first-century China because her father's crops have failed. Would she say, "I am dying from malnutrition, but in 2,000 years people will have plenty to eat and live in big, air-conditioned houses, so my suffering is a worthwhile sacrifice"? What then did wheat offer agriculturists, including that malnourished Chinese girl? It offered nothing for people as individuals. Yet it did bestow something on Homo sapiens as a species. Cultivating wheat provided much more food per unit of territory, and thereby enabled Homo sapiens to multiply exponentially. Around 13,000 BC, when people fed themselves by gathering wild plants and hunting wild animals, the area around the oasis of Jericho in Palestine could support at most one roaming band of about 100 relatively healthy and well-nourished people. Around 8,500 BC, when wild plants gave way to wheat fields, the oasis supported a large but cramped village of 1,000 people, who suffered far more from disease and malnourishment. The currency of evolution is neither hunger nor pain, but rather copies of DNA helixes. Just as the economic success of a company is measured only by the number of dollars in its bank account, not by the happiness of its employees, so the evolutionary success of a species is measured by the number of copies of its DNA. If no more DNA copies remain, the species is extinct, just as a company without money is bankrupt. If a species boasts many DNA copies, it is a success, and the species flourishes. From such a perspective, 1,000 copies are always better than 100 copies. This is the essence of the agricultural revolution, the ability to keep more people alive under worse conditions. Yet why should individuals care about this evolutionary calculus? Why would any sane person lower his or her standard of living just to multiply the number of copies of the Homo sapiens genome? Nobody agreed to this deal. The agricultural revolution was a trap. The luck